From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The map of and around Syria now looks like a deadly serious board game. More and more pieces cluttering the map each week. Turkish troops massing at the border. American special forces now nearby at a remote base in Jordan. Foreign fighters, a lot of them jihadists, slipping in through Iraq and Turkey to join the fight in Aleppo, Idlib, and beyond. Saudi Arabia and Qatar sending in money and arms. Civilians dying or fleeing in waves. Where is all this headed? This hour On Point, the evolving uprising in Syria. You can join the conversation. What do you see evolving, emerging in the bloody fight in Syria? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from, of all places, Portsmouth, Ohio, is Amar al-Azam. He's a member of the Syrian opposition, member of the executive committee of the Day After Project. It's a collaboration of Syrian opposition members funded by the U.S. Institute for Peace to prepare for a post-Assad Syria. He's a professor of Mideast history and anthropology at Shawnee State University. Amar al-Azam, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi there, Tom.
So you're a player in this, but how do you describe the state of this conflict at this point in Syria? Step back for us, Amar. How do you describe what's going on?
Well, right now, we have a what you would clearly be able to describe as an ongoing conflict. Some would go as far as describing it a civil war as well, although I know people still hesitate for various reasons to use that term. The state of the conflict itself, however, is in some ways stalemated, because right now on the political scene, there is very little political movement, with both sides basically polarized in terms of their position, and there are no real serious initiatives on the ground trying to help resolve this. You hear of efforts here and there, but I don't see any serious political activity going on that will help resolve the situation.
Assad is dug in, and the rebels at this point are unable to boot him out?
Absolutely. Politically speaking, yes, both are digging in politically, but also militarily both are dug in. Although you see gains here and there by one side or the other, neither side really has the ability to basically defeat the other side militarily on the battlefield as yet. And what you are waiting for now is a game changer, I suppose, which will raise the stakes. And this could well be, we could well see this right after the elections here in the U.S., when we've received a number of signals from United States government, irrespective of who wins, whether it's Romney or Obama, that we will see a significant change in policy. And I think that may tip the balance in favor of the opposition.
So a stalemate waiting for a game changer. One game changer would be U.S. involvement. What might that look like? If you've got hints or clues or expectations from Romney and Obama camps, like what?
I think the what we will see is more a allowing or permitting the other, through NATO indirectly, maybe through Turkey, actually being allowed to actually take some sort of action on the ground, perhaps in the form of being a little more aggressive in its response, even perhaps being able to push into Syria to create the safe area or safe zone that is now being talked about in northern Syria. Alternatively, and also more likely, is the providing the armed rebels, the opposition, with the necessary type of weapons that would be used against aircraft, particularly to bring down the regime's fighter planes and helicopters. They've been very effective in holding back the opposition from making major gains.
So maybe a safe zone along the Syrian border with Turkey for refugees, and for that matter for rebels. More arms, heavier weapons. There have been lighter weapons coming in, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others. Mm-hmm. What about a no-fly zone? I see talk of that here that would actually have NATO, or I'm not sure who's, but outside air power suppressing Syria's air power, keeping it out of the skies.
I think that's essentially what you will see. You will see Also possibly some sort of no-fly zone, at least over the northern strip. That would be one way of enforcing the the safe area that we're talking about. It would actually have a huge impact because, but you would also need to push the land-based artillery, the long-range artillery of the regime, back far enough to prevent it also from shelling the safe zone. We also hear of the you know, once the opposition manages to get itself a government, a transitional government, that would also be expected to go and you know, reside in these liberated or if you want, you know, safe area, and for them to be able to operate there with some security, then there has to be a measure. We have to ensure that they aren't going to be shelled from, you know, the long-range artillery or the aircraft.
Stalemate, says our opposition member today. Amar al-Azm, stand by there if you'd be good enough. Here's the sound from some amateur video uploaded to YouTube on Sunday that shows Syrian rebels apparently opening fire in the streets of Aleppo. And that's the least of it. It has been very, very heavy fighting in Syria. Amar al-Azm, please stand by with us right now from London. Is Haith Abdul Ahad, correspondent for the British newspaper The Guardian. He's been covering the Syrian uprising extensively, most recently in Aleppo and Idlib in August and September. He's reported for PBS's Frontline, for the Washington Post, and many others. Haith Abdul Ahad, thank you very much for being with us. Do you see a stalemate at this point in Syria?
Thank you, Haitham. Yes, of course. I mean, I totally agree with Amar's earlier analysis about the situation. It's stalemate. Neither the government nor the opposition forces are able to dislodge, you know, the other forces from the ground. They, you know, they fight over like tiny little front lines. But the reality is the government has lost most of the countryside, at least in the north, in Aleppo and Idlib, even around Deir ez-Zor in the east. And the rebels are incapable of, you know, driving the government forces from major towns, from major bases, partly because of, you know, the air force, the artillery. But I think the main problem here is not about weapons, it's not NATO, it's not anything else.
Okay.
There is no organization. There is no one commander, there is no one opposition group, be it the National Council, the FSA, or anything that can claim to represent, you know, the forces on the ground. You know, I've seen front lines with 150 men, you know, belonging to 5-6 different groups, unable to coordinate. So I don't think the issue is about weapons. About, I mean, of course, it's important to get more weapons to get for the opposition. But the reality is they are so disorganized. There are a plethora of commanders, a plethora of organization, a plethora of, you know, different people who kind of claim to be commanders, to be Supreme Military Council.
Yeah. I'll put that to Amar al-Azm, but from your perspective, I mean, what about this depiction that we're now getting, that among the rebel, among the opposition itself, there's this kind of fractured picture of interests that could itself lead to a fight on the other side, even of an Assad departure, that you've got the original Syrians who rose up here, that you've got a lot of jihadis who have come in from outside, that they're being better armed by Saudi Arabia and Qatar than many of the locals who may not have the same religious fervor. What about that, Kate?
No, I agree with Abdul Ahad. You know, the other critical component is the fractured nature of the Syrian opposition. Politically, there is, unfortunately, until now, the Syrian opposition has been unable to produce a unified or at least a stable political opposition that can speak in one way, in some form or the other, on behalf of the Syrian people as a whole. You have different factions. Some are more prominent, some are less prominent. And then also militarily on the ground, you have many, many different factions. And the reason why you have all these different groups on the ground fighting is in part because the political entities of the opposition have been unable to unite themselves and then take the lead, if you want, and lead the military aspect on the ground.
I'm going to stand by there for a moment, if you'd be good enough. I want to put it to Haith Abdul Ahad in London. Haith, what about this picture that's being presented of outside jihadis coming in, sort of taking over the rebellion or being better armed? Is that credible? Is that real? Have you seen evidence of that on the ground?
I mean, I've seen jihadis on the ground. I've seen far more jihadis than I've seen in Somalia or Iraq or anyone else. I've seen Chechens, I've seen Turks, I've seen, you know, Moroccans, Saudis. That is true. But I disagree with this latest kind of, you know, report that the jihadis are better armed than the other groups. They're armed like everyone else. I've seen the other groups basically getting, you know, the weapons from outside, sharing their weapons with everyone fighting on the front line, including the jihadis. So I disagree with the fact that the jihadis are the main dominant force now on the ground in Syria. They are a big dominant force. They are like maybe 10-15% of the whole picture, and that is, you know, Syrian and foreign jihadis, and then less than that you have the foreign jihadis. So it's a huge problem, but they are not the biggest issue, and they can be, you know, taken over very quickly. There have been incidents where, you know, the local fighters on the ground, you know, the local, you know, local Syrians fighter, they turn against the jihadis. They've senior commander been killed. They are not the biggest issue now. The issue is, as you know, Omar was saying, is the organization, I think.
But has it been a source of hesitance for the U.S., afraid that if they arm the opposition, they might, in effect, arm, you know, fundamentalist Salafist jihadis who would then present them with some kind of also antagonistic regime on the other side of Assad?
Well, of course, it's been the source of hesitance. But from the beginning, they were hesitating about talking to the opposition to the extent that they've allowed these different groups to emerge on the ground in the land of chaos. You know, those people are emerging as the dominant, not the dominant force, but as a main strong force to be reckoned with. And that is partly because of, you know, the international community hesitated, kept fearing the collapse of Syria, what will happen to Syria, and allowed those people to emerge.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the evolving uprising in Syria, where it's going, where it ends, who's fighting there now. During last week's vice presidential debate, candidate Paul Ryan accused the Obama administration of doing too little to help the Syrian uprising and relying too much on the UN, on Russia, while things went the wrong way, he said.
The longer this has gone on, the more people, groups like Al-Qaeda are going in. We could have more easily identified the Free Syrian Army, the Freedom Fighters, working with our allies, the Turks, the Qataris, the Saudis, had we had a better plan in place to begin with, working through our allies.
Syria in the middle of the U.S. presidential campaign now. Paul Ryan right there. Vice President Joe Biden in the debate last week hit back hard at Ryan and Mitt Romney for their claims that they would have done more on Syria. War, he warned.
And all this loose talk of my friend Governor Romney and the congressman about how we're going to do, we could do so much more in there. What more would they do other than put American boots in the ground? The last thing America needs is to get in another ground war in the Middle East.
The warning from Vice President Biden there in the vice presidential debate last week. Haith Abdul-Ahad is with us, correspondent for The Guardian. He's reported a lot from this region, joins us from London today. Amr al-Azam is with us from Portsmouth, Ohio, member of the Syrian opposition, member of the Executive Committee of the Day After Project, a collaboration funded by the U.S. Institute for Peace. We've got questions coming in here. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I watched the debate between Vice President Biden and Paul Ryan, and at one point Congressman Ryan pointed out that the Russians, he said, are arming the Assad regime. And I thought it was interesting that the Vice President turned and it seemed to me glared at Ryan and said, and the opposition is being armed. And it seemed to me the implication was pretty clear that we're doing the arming of the Syrian opposition, which kind of makes sense, seeing as how they've been able to sustain and actually gain a lot of ground in this time. So I guess my question is, do your guests believe that the United States is in fact arming the Syrian rebels? And secondly, do they agree with Paul Ryan's accusation that Iran is flying combat flights over Syria?
We'll look at those, Mark. Thank you. Keith, speak first to what the U.S. is and is not doing, as far as you know, in this region. Arming, not arming, otherwise, what's the picture?
I mean, I don't think they're arming. I've seen front lines where people kind of, you know, actually have only, you know, 600, 500 bullets between them on a front line. So, no, I don't think anyone's arming. I think the arming situation is kind of an ad hoc situation. Smugglers from Iraq, smugglers from Lebanon, kind of black market from Turkey. There is no consistent, systematic way of arming the rebels. But can I add one line? Biden was saying kind of the last thing America needs is boots on the ground. I think the last thing the Middle East needs is more American boots on the ground. So I don't think America should be involved in this. It's a Syrian uprising. It's a Syrian issue. International community, yes, maybe.
Well, can we stick with the arming for a second? Because I think our listener is correct that Joe Biden, in his facial expression and his tone, suggested that, come on, behind the scenes, we are making sure that arms get to them. There's lots of reports in the American press, Keith, of arms coming with support from Saudi Arabia, from Qatar. Is that not happening?
Money is coming from Saudi Arabia, from Qatar. There were few shipments of, I've seen, you know, brand new RPG rockets, brand new bullets, and these are different from the weapons, you know, brought by the smugglers. So, of course, the Americans would be, you know, given the green light for this brand new ammunition to arrive to the rebels. But again, I've been covering this conflict for more than a year, and I've seen the arms situation. If the Americans were funding the rebels, as, you know, people are suggesting, then you would see a lot of ammunition. The situation in Aleppo, for example, which is one of the biggest, most important battles for the rebels, the stalemate, the stagnation is because of the lack of ammunition. Had the Saudis and Qataris been supporting, and the Americans, been supporting the rebels the way they've been portrayed, it will be a much different situation.
Well, everybody says it's not heavy weapons, not even shoulder-fired kind of rockets that can bring down aircraft. What about the, as our listener heard it, I'm trying to recall now, he's saying Paul Ryan suggested that Iranians were deeply involved here, Russians deeply involved. What about that, Keith?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen, I've seen drones fly on the skies of Aleppo, kind of government drones, and I presume that kind of Iranian technology. But I don't think the Syrians at this moment need kind of Iranian boots on the ground or the Russians to attack. They have enough, you know, boots on the ground. My point is, if we go back to the ammunition, the kind of Western support for the rebels, there's drops of ammunition reaching the rebels. It's enough to sustain them to resist, not enough to achieve anything on the ground. So, yes, there is support coming to the rebels. It's not a consistent, and it's not, definitely from the rebels' point of view, it's not enough.
Amar al-Azm, if we have a prolonged stalemate here, how does that unfold? You heard Paul Ryan there saying, the longer this goes on, with all these stalemate, but not without abundant death and casualties and refugees, lots, what does that produce?
Just let me just say one quick thing about the arms. I'm sorry.
But first,
remember that the biggest, some of the biggest gains in ammunition and weapons have not been through what has been coming, you know, through the borders, smuggled in or otherwise, but have actually been the gains made by the rebels themselves on the ground when they take over depots or they take over positions by the Syrians. That's where the heaviest equipment has been able to get to the rebels, the heavy machine guns, the anti-aircraft weapons that they do have. And that is very important because as the rebels are making more and more gains, painstakingly slow as is, and they get better arms through their own efforts, that means that they are less likely to be reliant on Western U.S. or international community.
And what does that mean? What does that suggest
that
in terms of outcomes?
Well, that's very important and very significant because in the outcome, as the conflict sort of progresses, they are not going to forget that we did not help them. And in a post-Assad Syria, people will remember, when we needed you, you weren't there. So now, why do you think you should have a stake in determining or shaping how a post-Assad Syria should look? And that's why it was very important, and we've insisted that it was very important that the U.S. does engage in some way, at least in helping provide the arms, because the rebels are going to get them eventually. Better they get them through us, better they get them and we control who gets them, than having them come in an ad hoc fashion as was just being mentioned, or, you know, the rebels getting them themselves from, gaining, looting the actual Syrian regime army units.
Tim in Toronto, Canada. Thanks for calling, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, this is not the Arab Spring. This is a 1914
situation. We're revisiting the possibility of a global conflict taking place in Syria. You've got regional powers waiting to engage with each other militarily. Saudis, Iran, behind Iran is Russia. Turkey, behind Turkey is NATO. This is an extremely explosive situation, something that we haven't seen since 1914, which led to the First World War.
Let us pick up that that perspective, Tim, and I appreciate your call. With us right now from Boston is Andrew Tabler. He's a senior fellow at the Washington Institute, author of In the Lion's Den, recently returned from Turkey and Lebanon, spent a month meeting with members of the armed opposition there. Andrew Tabler, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure, thank you.
Our listener looks here and he doesn't see Arab Spring. I don't think anybody has for a little while now, maybe. This is certainly roots of that. But he sees a 1914 Balkans powder keg that could ignite a regional, even broader conflict here. What do you say, Andrew?
Well, I think that certainly a lot of things came out of the bottle in the Arab Spring that we don't like, that we don't, in terms of the United States and its interests. That's, you know, that's for sure. I don't think that it's necessarily a regional war, but I certainly can say that, though, that, you know, the way we've seen the hurricane building in Syria, and I would agree with Haith and Amr as well. Mm-hmm. It's been a slow build. It's been a bloody build. And the reaction by the West and the Obama administration has been particularly strange, in the sense that it's not like they couldn't see the conflict brewing, but they just were very reticent to do anything directly to head it off. They were willing to do it indirectly, and I'm afraid by not acting directly, the U.S. has handed over a lot of its influence to people who share our short-term interest of bringing down President Assad, but certainly not our long-term interest in a secular and democratic Syria after this is all over.
Well, you heard Joe Biden in that debate. You could hear it in the tape we played. I mean, just making no bones about his very visceral distaste for the idea, and many Americans share this, of boots on the ground here, another American involvement, another war he's warning against.
Yeah, but no one is suggesting that. And what he's I mean, this is something that in watching Obama administration.
Well, I mean, he certainly was. The last thing America needs is to get into another ground war in the Middle East. That's the Vice President of the United States. That's somebody.
That's true, but he was deflecting from the fact that the Obama administration only has a couple of months' contact with the armed groups on the ground. You know, those who are taking the shots against Assad are going to be calling the shots after he's gone, and not to have contact with them earlier, just contact with them earlier, is a policy failure of the first magnitude. Now, Syria is a difficult case, so you have to cut the Obama administration a break. But the fact is that we could have done a lot more. We didn't. We spent a lot more time at the UN.
Is there no U.S. contact, really, Andrew? I mean, is the CIA not in there somehow? We've now heard there's special forces at a base across the border in Jordan. I think a lot of Americans assume that one way or another there is, in fact, contact.
Well, there is now, but it's been far too late. Overt contact with the State Department has only really gone back to about April or May, per se. So that's, you know, again, and I think Amr and Raif can tell you this. Look, you know, this is the Middle East. You don't just show up and go into a meeting and everybody's wearing a suit and you start shaking hands. You have to build relationships with people and you have to help them in their hour of need. That was a failure, and it's one that I think a lot of people in Washington continue to scratch their heads, because everyone could see this was getting worse, that there was no end in sight, and most importantly, that the diplomatic track was just not working.
Well, it's worse now. New Orleans, Ustaf is calling. Ustaf, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Tom. By the way, this is a very well-produced show. I definitely enjoy listening.
Thank you.
So I was basically wondering about like foreign aspect. I mean, we're talking very openly about, you know, how we have foreign powers arming, you know, various rebel groups. I feel like that's sort of re-entrenching Assad's argument that this is like a foreign decapitation of his administration or his regime. But I really wanted to talk about I wanted to ask more so the organizational capacity of the jihadis. If we're students of history, you'll remember the case of Iran, where you have this sort of secular uprising that sort of gets hijacked by the Islamists, and then now you have the birth of this theocracy. Mm-hmm. My question is, are the jihadis organized to such an extent? Do they have the sort of organizational strength where they can sort of, in the end game, apply the sort of theocratic government in the end.
We'll pick it straight up, and I appreciate your call, Ustaf. We're talking about the evolving uprising in Syria. Amar al-Azam, how about it? Our caller says, you know, will you have a, I mean, Syria has a the opposite of Islamist history here. There's a lot of secular history in Syria, but, you know, he's wondering if in the end, do jihadis step in and take over? Is that possible with the Syrian cultural identity?
No, because, and I think you're quite right. Look, we do not have a tradition of Salafism mm-hmm. or radical Islamism in Syria. We had a brief spate with the Muslim Brotherhood in the late 70s, early 80s, and Syrian society, although conservative in nature, is inimical, does not like politicized Islam, does not sit well with it. The Muslim Brotherhood do have some influence on the ground, but their influence would never really exceed 20%. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, I don't think Salafism, you know, it's a fresh ideology, it's new ideology. When it comes to elections, people will vote along cultural, ethnic, social lines. People will follow what they already know, what they feel comfortable with.
Well, if they get a vote, what if they don't even get a vote? I mean, we've seen other countries where it went straight from uprising to theocracy with no way station. At a vote.
Well, that is something that hopefully will not happen, and that is something that we in the opposition are obviously going to have to work on. Mm-hmm. But there, I don't think there is enough of a Salafi presence on the ground to be able to, you know, enforce such a thing.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have that kind of traction. I don't think they will ever get that kind of traction in Syria. Now, ever maybe is a big word, but certainly not in the given time frame that we're dealing with.
Mm. Andrew Tabler, what about it? Politicized Islam is inimical to Syria. Won't grow in this soil.
I think it'll grow in some parts of the country. I think in the Northwest, it's going to be a part of the general landscape, which is going to, you know, which I think is going to lean Islamist. You know,
what you're talking, Idlib, Aleppo.
Aleppo and so on. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's
big cities.
Most conservative part. I mean, Amr's right. The Sunni community inside of Syria is diverse. You have conservatives in some areas, some who are observant but not so conservative in urban areas. You have tribal Sunnis in eastern Syria, those south of Damascus, which are essentially like settled tribes in many ways, and then we have, of course, Kurds. So, but certainly in some areas, like, you know, when Khalid was talking about this earlier and so on, when you go into the northern parts of Syria, you know, you find there people who we would regard here in the United States as fundamentalists, and some of those are extremists. Does that mean that that's who's going to take over, though? No, because the different units are headed by different people. Some are local people who are more conservative and more religious and reflect those communities. Mm. Others are defectors from the military, and they came up through the Ba'athi system. And those that I've met do not seem as fundamentalist, and there are a variety of ways to tell that. But it doesn't mean that in the end that these more extreme forces can't maneuver for power. And I think this is what your caller was referring to, the Iranian Revolution. And of course, there we saw an outcome which was not in favor of certainly of democracy and interest with the West.
Hey, what is that American base in Jordan that Leon Panetta, the defense secretary, has been talking about recently? Special forces there, and so what's that about?
I guess it's some kind of sort of special forces and a kind of some a command structure that would, you know, expand eventually in case of a regional war or regional conflict. But if I can add something about the issue of the jihadis and the Islamists,
yes.
I think there is a lot of, you know, romanticization of the issue that, you know, we Syrians, we've never been kind of supporting the radical Islamists. We will not support them. You know, the Iraqis didn't know the jihadis before 2003, and suddenly the jihadis became a huge power. So
yeah.
The jihadis can grow in a conflict situation. So I don't think we can argue that because the Syrians never been Salafis or jihadis, they will, you know, they will never do something like that. And then before reaching the concept, like the point of jihadis, we can talk about a very radical fundamentalist organization, Islamic, you know, organization or whatever, that can spread and are spreading at this moment. So this is, you know, suddenly from an Arab Spring, and I still think it's an Arab Spring mm-hmm. revolution, it's been taken over into a direction that is, you know, it will be very difficult to retract later.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the evolving uprising in Syria, where it's going, where it ends, who's fighting. Andrew Tabler is with us from the Washington Institute. Amar al-Azam, member of the Syrian opposition, is here. Haith Abdul-Ahad, correspondent for The Guardian, who spent a lot of time in the region, is with us from London. Lots of talk about this, very high profile lately. Mitt Romney, big foreign policy speech at the Virginia Military Institute this month, and said he would do more to help the rebels, cast the whole effort as the whole scene as a kind of struggle with Iran.
In Syria, I'll work with our partners to identify and organize those members of the opposition who share our values, and then ensure that they obtain the arms they need to defeat Assad's tanks and helicopters and fighter jets. Iran is sending arms to Assad because they know his downfall would be a strategic defeat for them. We should be working no less vigorously through our international partners to support the many Syrians who would deliver that defeat to Iran.
Support, deliver defeat to Iran. There's Mitt Romney. Here's the vice president again, Joe Biden, saying they're doing a lot already, the Obama administration, to create a safe and peaceful post-Assad Syria. Here's Biden.
We are working hand in glove with the Turks, with the Jordanians, with the Saudis, and with all the people in the region, attempting to identify the people who deserve the help so that when Assad goes, and he will go, there will be a legitimate government that follows on, not an Al-Qaeda-sponsored government that follows on.
Hand in glove, he will go. Al-Qaeda-sponsored government. A lot of questions come up there. A couple of calls, and we'll go to them. Kevin in Mount Vernon, Iowa. Kevin, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I'm not an Obama fan as a Republican, but I think they're very wise to approach this with great caution. Our memory seems to be kind of short back in, you know, when we were supporting in Afghanistan or the rebels against the Soviets. There's blowback. There's consequences. Policy has consequences.
Yep.
And here we are 30-some years later fighting the consequences of that action.
So you say hesitate all you like, White House. Stay out, maybe.
Well, I mean, approach cautiously, contain the explosion to the other gentleman's point about the Balkans, you know, and this baby being predecessor to World War One type of scenario. Well, don't forget, without World War One and U.S. intervention, we don't have World War Two. So, caution.
There's a long chain. Of course, lots of things have consequences, but we'll look at that. Kevin, I appreciate your call. Caution is the word there. Let's go to Los Angeles, California. Chris is calling. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My point is to the comment about how the president isn't involved as much as he should be. I don't know how much that means, because in Egypt we were really involved, and you know they elected somebody that doesn't agree with us on much. So I guess I just don't see why that's such a big deal.
Well, okay. I mean, really involved. I don't know. People will debate that one as well. Say the Egyptians really took the bit in their teeth there. But you're quite right. U.S. influence on the other side of that, you could argue all day how significant it is. Let us pick these up. Andrew, let me come first to you with our callers. And you hear the hesitance there about getting involved. The caution word from Iowa, you know, there's a long chain here. Let's just not get in there. What about consequences, in or out, Andrew?
Well, I agree with that, and I think the caution is necessary. But there's a difference between caution before acting, before actively getting involved, before directly intervening, and that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about hesitancy just to engage with the groups themselves. And what I mean by engagement is just talk to them and say, hey, who are you, what do you believe in, and where do you think this is going? And we just didn't do that. I mean, I think that, and I'm not doing this from the opposition bleachers, I lean Democratic myself, you know, domestically, but if I look at this as an analyst, somebody who's been covering this for years, I can tell you very clearly that the administration should have, from an earlier stage, been able to identify which groups we could work with, and they didn't. And
well, that's not what Biden said last week. I mean, you heard him in that tape. He said we are working hand in glove.
That's true, but the uprising has gone militarized for well over a year. How is it that after all of this time we don't have any kind of idea where the assistance should be going? I mean, there should be an active debate on it. Now, look, I mean, this is all water under the bridge. Now we're going to have to do the hard work of getting into this game late and also coming up with a political strategy to work with these groups so that when they do overrun the areas of Syria, when the regime begins to give way, that we have influence with those groups so that they don't turn radical, so that they don't do things that we don't want them to do. And you know, it's not going to be a perfect process, but you know, in order to win this game, we're going to have to play it to a certain extent, but it does not involve boots on the ground and the kind of direct intervention that we've seen in the past.
Amar al-Azm, how does that hit your ear when you hear Andrew Taylor say, we don't know to whom the assistance should go? I mean, you're with the Syrian opposition. Do you know where it should go?
We know where the assistance should go, but the problem is that the administration itself, as Andrew was saying quite rightly, took its time to try and figure out who's who when they could have done this much more quickly. And more importantly, it's the case of if we're coming into this game, behind, and we're coming in late, and the later we delay in actually engaging with the opposition and engaging effectively and being actually on the game here, the more likely it is that the opposition and the groups on the ground will not see us in a favorable light. Already there are people who are saying and interpreting our lack of engagement, appropriate engagement, as that the exact opposite, that we actually want Assad to stay, and that is why we're not supporting them. And that's not a good thing to be hearing.
Let's get a call from New York. Sheikh Ahmed is calling from New York. Sheikh Ahmed, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
Tom, I participated early a couple of times about Syria, and I want to emphasize the same stance that, or the same opinion that the international community should have acted very quickly to push Libya's scenario and should have got rid of the regime earlier.
But they didn't. So what's your question now? We just have Andrew for another minute or two.
I was talking about the Iranian tanks that they will come to defend the Bashar, because the Iranian war should be always there in Lebanon or in Syria or somewhere else. It's better for them or Iraq than on the assault of Iran. Anyways, my question now is, what if we are surprised, or the conflict now is surprised by a game changer from Al-Qaeda, probably supported by Russia? They can use Al-Qaeda the same way American used Al-Qaeda against them in Afghanistan. They might support Al-Qaeda now and have it do the same thing that happened in north of Mali. I'm actually from Mauritania, and we are dealing with Al-Qaeda now.
You mean, where they actually take over some territory?
Yes, and you can't tell me that Al-Qaeda is not able to have an area now in Syria and declare independence, especially that Syria might be interested in dividing the country to keep a portion of it under the control.
Well, there's an image. Let us pick that up, and I thank you for your call, Andrew. We've just got you for a couple of minutes. Can you picture that? Can you visualize somehow Al-Qaeda emerging here as, sovereign in some corner of Syria?
I don't think that's in the cards as I see it now. But of course, it depends on how the conflict goes. Could there be parts of Syria where you have Al-Qaeda affiliates who have bases? Yeah, we already have that. Now, could they be sovereign or over large swaths? I think there would be a lot of constraints on that. Look, getting to its original question, though, concerning Iran, the biggest issue, and this is something that hasn't come out, the fact is that the Iranians, and you can see this in public statements because the Iranians have admitted this publicly, they're actually very busy in the country now transforming what are called the Shabiha, which are Alawite thugs, which are used to beat up and kill and harass the opposition. And they're transforming them into a paramilitary group called Jaish-e-Shabi, the Popular Army. And the IRGC Quds Force is very involved in this transformation. So already we can see the Iranians playing a game there. We can also see extremists coming in. And we're going to have to take a much more, active look at this in terms of, is the country going to actually in the end be partitioned? Is it going to be in parts as the regime collapses? So, and what are we going to do if that happens and there's not just one Syria, but Syria is?
Wow. Question after question here, and consequence after consequence. Andrew, I know we have to let you go. Senior fellow at the Washington Institute, Andrew Tabler, author of In the Lion's Den. Thank you very much for joining us today, Andrew.
Thank you.
Let's get a call right here from Amherst, Massachusetts. Charlie's calling. Hi, Charlie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Lost in all the talk of where the Syrian civil war is going is really the role of the media in furthering the appetite in this country for U.S. intervention and increasing the likelihood that the killing will go on. The media has really taken sides in this conflict, and therefore it really is impartial. It's not capable of being impartial. It's turned into a mouthpiece for the U.S. government.
Let me be sure I understand what you mean. Do you think the media has come down, is partial in that it's against Assad?
I think the media is pro-opposition, and it's very clear in the reporting that comes through.
Yeah.
It takes one side over the other. I mean, there's an old truism, and it really holds in Syria. Truth is always the first casualty of war.
But isn't it kind of natural or inevitable for the American media to look at a dictator and then look at a lot of dead civilians in the streets and a lot of torture in a time of Arab Spring and be sympathetic to those rising up against that dictator?
I think you have to be clear on what is going on. The ethical responsibility of the media is to put forth impartial reporting, not to take sides.
Well, but I think you could look at it the other way, Charlie. There's been so much death there. And, you know, there's the humanitarian argument that that's unacceptable. And has that really had a full airing in the American media? It seems to me America's largely looked away.
I'm going to point out, Tom, that, you know, there was a U.S. civil war in this country that claimed the lives of hundreds of thousands of civilians who were directly, not necessarily targeted, but directly died because of the hardships and the starvation of the war here. And we wind up, who should have intervened in this war on the behalf of those civilians? Tell me. That is the parallel that I see at this point.
Let them have their fight. Charlie, I've got the perspective, and I hear your message. I appreciate your call. Amr al-Azam, you're with the opposition in Syria. You say there should have already been some kind of American support. You say you expect some kind of American involvement after the election. But you hear in our listeners' calls lots of resistance to that. What do you think about that?
Well, look, I mean, 2 points here. One, and no one really is talking about American boots on the ground, certainly. I don't think the Middle East needs it. I don't think Syrians, if you ask them directly, do you want troops on the ground?
Yeah, but Americans have learned it doesn't have to be boots on the ground to constitute involvement. You start doing a, you know, no-fly zone. You start opening up safe zones in the north of the country. Yeah, you're in there.
Yeah, of course. But I think most Americans are afraid of boots on the ground.
Yeah.
They're not as resistant, perhaps, to other forms of assistance. I think that's critical. The second point, and really, is to do with the fact that if we don't get involved, okay, there is a humanitarian catastrophe unfolding in front of us. You know, do we just turn our backs on situations like that? There's a dictator that is massacring his people on the ground. So do we just continue to allow him to do that? Ultimately, remember, this whole thing was started by the Syrian people. It was not started by some foreign government. It was not started by the media. It was started by the Syrian people in direct response to a terrible atrocity that was committed by the regime against the children of Daraa, who were taken away, tortured, had their fingernails pulled out, burnt, etc. That this is what started it. And ultimately, when you step in, there is a moral... We claim to occupy in the United States the moral high ground, you know.
Mm.
Well, if we wish to maintain this moral high ground, from time to time, we have to step in and also fulfill that obligation. You know, we can't be the good guys in the world and then just say, yes, we are the good guys, but we don't want to be involved. You know, sometimes we just have to bite the bullet.
Well, here you are sitting far from the conflict, you know, at Shawnee State University supporting the opposition. So maybe it's, you know, you've got a kind of cool seat to watch this from, though I'm sure it's terribly, you must be distraught at what you see. But what's your vision? What's the best? There's a lot of fear about the worst of the Balkans, World War VII or whatever. What's the best vision that could come out of this that seems feasible, Amr? What would you like to see that's feasible?
Ideally, we'd like to see the regime go. We'd like to see the Assad regime fall. We'd like to see a rapid transition to democracy, to free elections, to a civil society. This is the ideal situation. But unfortunately, the trajectory that we are on now is more conflict, possible balkanization of the country, a breaking up, fragmentation, and perhaps a protracted form of civil war for the next few years. And this is because of the delays. There were windows of opportunity very early on in this conflict, which had the international community, had the United States, had the Obama administration taken advantage of those, then we could have certainly shortened that. But we didn't do that, and now the trajectory is not looking very happy, unfortunately. I don't have a good answer for you.
Hey, Abul Ahad, will Assad just stay? Maybe after all this, he just stays there and maybe never goes.
I don't know if never is an option here, but I think at this moment is you know, he is well dug in and he can see this fragmented opposition fighting him. Maybe he will concede with holding on to bits of Aleppo, bits of Damascus, most of the major cities. And remember, Najibullah held to Afghanistan long after, you know, the Soviet left, and it was the collapse of the Soviet Union that kind of ushered his collapse. But you know, there is a lot of talk about what America should do in the Middle East, what America should do in Syria. And at the end of the day, I don't think they have much options to do. I mean, you know, you've seen Libya. These uprisings, these revolutions, they take their own course, and the course is taken by the people themselves. So, you know, America can be involved, America cannot be involved, but what happens on the ground happens based on local issues. It's not, you know, America would be involved tomorrow, it would not change the course of the uprising. It's based on, it's the uprising of local people.
So maybe it goes on its merry way, but what are the consequences if it does just roll on?
Very horrible. I mean, I totally disagree with the caller earlier who said, like, you know, the media is not being objective. I mean, you cannot be objective when you see, you know, a group of people demonstrating in the street or carrying arms and a regime that's oppressing them. There is no, you know, you can't be objective in this kind of situation. So, yes, of course you have to be involved. But what I'm trying to say that America cannot engineer the outcome of this uprising.
Well, we may get a chance to witness whether or not that's true, for better or worse. Haith Abdul Ahad with The Guardian in London today. Thank you so much for joining us. And Amar al-Azam with the Syrian opposition at Shawnee State in Ohio. Thank you very much to both of you for being with us today. This is On Point.